Get started, so if you take your seats.
Am I okay here, Tommy? Sorry. Joe just called out to another commitment with the county exec's office. So here instead.
Okay.
We have a short presentation follow MDE.
Right. Okay, welcome everyone. We have a tight agenda, and usually what we do is we go around the room and introduce ourselves, where we're from, and favorite things we like to do on the river, but we're not going to do that today because I want to get moving. But what I do want is for those that are officially on the council or commission, whatever it's called, just to raise your hands. Okay, and as we do this today, what I just want you to know, you've got a mix of stakeholders from the community, from the environmental groups and elsewhere, and from the PRPs, and of course my staff are here. But in terms of each presentation, if there's time left over, I will invite questions from the rest, but it's the council that has the right and the floor to ask questions and make recommendations as we go, because that's why you were sworn in. And so you will get priority, and then when your concerns are addressed, then I can keep it open to the floor, but primarily it's you guys. And so we've got a packed agenda. You see what all that we have here. And I know that Tony Williams had intended... Oh, welcome. Welcome. And Tony, there's a seat for you right there. So, Tony, we're going to skip introductions, and we're going to move into a heavy agenda. And if someone will give Tony the agenda, and I'll go over it very quickly. But, Tony, what I just reminded folks is that we have a sworn-in commission, and that they have priority for questions and concerns. And I've got staff here, but we also have other advocates and stakeholders. But the priority is the commission to be able to help, do their job, which is to speak and whatever. So let me go over the agenda, and then Tony, if you want to have opening remarks as well. So we're going to hear from Maryland after opening remarks. And as you know, we've been talking quite a bit about upstream and continuing contamination. And we had Secretary Ben Grumbles here and his team last time, and that they will do a presentation. Then feasibility studies on beneficial reuse, and what, for those that are not sure what that means, that's reuse for whatever dredgings there are, or anything from the river bottom. Are there beneficial reuse? Because that's one of the major cost drivers. Anytime you pull material out of the river, where do you put it, and who takes it, and how do you haul it? But if we're doing a study on reusing it in the area. And then project updates on the river corridor. Then, of course, takeaways from the 10th Annual Conference on Remediation and Management Contaminated Sediments, which has got to be one of the most fun conferences. Who all went to that conference? All right. And then the community engagement calendar, Gretchen will go over that, and then we'll have some further discussions. Leading off those further discussions will be Jim Foster from the Anacostia Watershed Society. And so with that, let me first ask my co-leader, Mary Williams.
I don't really have anything to add. I'm happy to be here and look forward to the very substantive agenda.
Great. Thank you. All right, with that, first we'll be hearing from Greg Bush, and I think in this same presentation it'll be Jeff DeHaan and Chris Clark and Dev. Will Dev and Wesley be part of this, and Aaron?
No, they're the next presentation.
They're the next presentation. Okay, so why don't we start with our folks from Maryland.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Greg Bush from the Maryland Department of the Environment Integrated Water Planning Program. When they talk about Maryland's activities to address PCBs in the Anacostia River, I come from the water side of things, so my focus is always the Clean Water Act and a lot of the things going on. I'm going to explain how they relate to what we're doing under the Clean Water Act. So here's a simple schematic that I prepared to show everything that's been going on so far. So I'm going to walk through this, and this will actually kind of act as an outline for the presentation. So this, going back to about 2000 here, this black area represents the work that we've done for TMDL development. So prior to 2000, we had fish consumption advisories for PCBs in fish tissue. We did follow-up monitoring to that, and based on that follow-up monitoring, we developed a couple of TMDLs. We developed a TMDL for PCBs in the tidal Anacostia in 2007 and one for the non-tidal Anacostia in 2011. As we did that monitoring and we were developing TMDLs, we started to ask ourselves, can we go a little further here and actually get into tracking down the sources of some of these PCBs more specifically than just for developing load estimates. So this red area here represents the series of follow-up studies we did throughout the state and in the Anacostia to try to drill down on what was going on. This sort of, I guess it's orange on this green area here, is work through our contaminated site cleanup that was going on. Concurrently, a lot of the sites that had previously been cleaned up, we went back in there to look to see if, given some of the fish tissue information we were finding, there was the potential for those to be PCB, causing PCB pollution. Now, more recently, we get these blue areas here, and these blue lines each represent different kind of permitting mechanisms we have in place to address PCBs. We have our wastewater and our MS4 permits, where we have source tracking efforts that'll be going on. And then we have industrial stormwater permits and construction permits that are in place as well and have mechanisms for addressing sediment. So I'll start off here with our TMDLs. So the 2000 TMDL for PCBs in the tidal Anacostia attributed loadings to different parts of the watershed. Areas of the watershed here are shown in colors, and those match what's on the pie chart. So about three quarters of the loading from that 2007 TMDL showed that three quarters of the loading came from the DC drainage, and about a quarter came from Maryland's non-tidal drainage. Of the portion coming from Maryland, that's this part of the pie right here, about three quarters of that was coming from lower Beaver Dam Creek. So what we've seen is this is generally consistent so far. We haven't seen the report yet, but the presentations we've seen for the USGS study in the Anacostia tributaries seem to be consistent with this, with higher levels coming from lower Beaver Dam Creek. And then the TMDLs required 98% reductions to PCBs throughout the watershed, so pretty significant level of effort that needs to be done. Getting to the mod tracking studies we did in 2005, we're starting to do TMDLs, and we said let's go across the entire state and see if we can do these source track down studies. So we took baskets of freshwater clams and from pristine waters and placed them in different areas for a couple weeks, and then looked at the accumulation of PCBs in the fish tissue over that period of time. We initially did in 2005, I think we did four sites, and then did a higher resolution study 2 years later where we went back and did 19 more stations. And the major finding from those studies that we saw the highest levels of PCB accumulation at a station just at Old Landover Road. So those were the 2005 and 2007 studies. In 2009, we came back and did a more comprehensive study within upstream of the Landover Road station. And we found of those, I think we looked at different outfalls here, and we found of the different outfalls that we monitored, the highest concentrations were coming from Station 16, kind of up there at the top. 2009, we came back two years later in 2011 and found that the concentrations had dropped back down to levels similar to what we were seeing at the other outfalls. So this is one of the problems we've run into. You know, one of the challenges we've had with these source tracking efforts is PCBs are ubiquitous. They seem to be everywhere, but also there's a very high variability in the results we found. So it's always that the linkage of tying the what we're seeing in the stream to a specific discharge, terrestrial discharge, always becomes, you know, that's the key challenge we're facing here. I think it's important to note that even though we saw the discharge, a decrease at Site 16, we continue to see higher concentrations at the old Landover Road Station, which is consistent with, I think, research that's been done by Dr. Upal Ghosh of UMBC, where they're seeing high concentrations in stream there as well. So in, that was 2009 through 2011, 2011 through 2013, we came back, and instead of looking from the stream up into the watershed to try to find these studies, we did a study where we actually looked at the sites and tried to look almost down into the watershed to see if those sites were potential sources of PCBs. And we focused on mostly federal facilities in the northeast branch right there. We did find higher concentrations at one of the sites in 2009. We did some additional studies a couple years later, and we couldn't find any downstream impact from that site as well. So, you know, those were kind of outlining a lot of the source tracking efforts that we'd done up to that point. We have gone in the intervening years, we worked more with UMBC and have been trying to refine our approaches for source tracking. We're doing a study right now in Baltimore County with Dr. Ghosh as well to see if we can really refine these approaches to the point where we're able to really make that linkage between the water and the land. I think that's going to be critical for us. We also have work going on right now through our MS4 permits, and so our most recent MS4 permits issued in 2013 and 2014 required our permittees to develop implementation plans for TMDLs. And so Montgomery and Prince George's County have both developed PCB implementation plans, and as part of that, they'll be doing a source track down to try to identify these things, hopefully building off the sampling studies that we've done previously. MDE is going to be a partner on those source track down approaches. We're contracting with UMBC as well to try to see if we can extend that and really start to identify these things. I think the collaboration we do with DOE and other entities is critical here, and the Anacostia Tributary Toxics Work Group has been a great place for us to really share knowledge and make sure that we're coordinating these efforts and understand what everyone's doing. We also have industrial stormwater permits throughout the watershed. We've gone through our industrial stormwater permit database and looked at the potential dischargers of PCBs in there, and we believe there's about 22. The dischargers are required to meet sediment benchmarks within their permit, so they're expected to look at sediment concentrations, and if there's concentrations above a certain level, put in sediment remediation actions as well. Also have permit requirements for good housekeeping, making sure that if there's equipment stored on site that could potentially be leaking or have oils coming out of it, that's not allowed to be discharged into the environment. And so we're routinely inspecting these sites, making sure they're practicing the housekeeping as expected under the permit. We're looking right now into options for doing additional PCB monitoring at those sites. So instead of just looking at sediment controls, going in and actually a monitoring for PCBs to you know, again, make that connection between, okay, could this individual facility be a significant source of PCB loads. Construction permit as well. has similar pollution controls like we'd expect in the, you know, industrial permits. So they're a lot required to do, have sediment and erosion controls in those permits to capture the sediment coming off those sites. Since PCBs are going to attach to the sediments that are exported from the site, those should have a positive impact in limiting, you know, any potential PCB contamination. EPA issued its construction permit in 2017, which has a bunch of new requirements in it, things like making sure that demolition of older buildings that could potentially contain PCBs are done in a controlled manner that's not potentially allowing the PCBs to enter the stormwater. So we're considering those in our next permit as well, which will be coming up in the next couple of years. And we're also, like with the industrial facilities, looking to see if there are mechanisms for doing PCB sampling at those construction sites as well, just to understand the scope of what's going on. Municipal wastewater treatment plants. There are two municipal wastewater treatment plants that Maryland's regulated or that have discharge permits in the non-tidal waters. Both of them are Northeast Branch. They're facilities owned by USDA. And so as a result of the non-tidal PCB TMDL, they're required to do quarterly monitoring for PCBs. And the result of that is, you know, they've also had to do, as a result of the PCBs they've seen there, they've had to do PCB source track down plans, source identification plans to look for potential sources of PCBs into their collection systems. So kind of getting going past the all the discharge permits, talk a little bit about the contaminated sites. There was actually, it says eight, but there were seven contaminated site cleanups done within the watershed that had PCBs involved with them. As a result of some of the fish tissue work we were seeing, we ended up actually going in between 2008 and 2012 and reopening those and taking a look at the records and doing sampling where necessary to see if there's a potential for those to be potential sources of PCBs. At the time, they found they were meeting their regulatory requirement. And there was no necessity to do additional cleanup. So that's a summary of where we've been, and I talked a little bit about where we're going, but I'm going to summarize it all on one slide right here. So we've got, through our MS4 permits, source track down studies that'll be going on in Montgomery County and Prince George's County, where NDE will be partnering and UMBC as well to try to identify sources of PCBs. Through our industrial permits, we'll be doing site inspections and review pollution prevention plans, making sure they're following best practices for housekeeping and sediment controls. And then we're looking at developing protocols right now for actually going in and monitoring specifically for PCBs from discharges coming from those industrial and construction sites. And then last, we have USDA East and West are doing source track down studies within their collection systems to see, you know, to see if they can find any potential sources of PCBs there as well. I don't have it listed here, but I'm going to point out that the coordination that we do with DOEE and COG and everyone probably represented in this room here is really important through the tributary, Anacostia tributary work group at, so that's an important place for us to get information and share information as well to make sure our efforts are coordinated and we're not kind of retreading on the same ground that others have already got down, making sure we're actually moving the science forward and understanding what's happening here. So,
all right, so Greg, don't go anywhere. We're going to take some questions before we get to Prince George's County. Jim?
Greg, thank you. It was great. Can you just give us a couple sentences about the different levels? So your enforcement action levels might be at 1 or 5 to 50 parts per million, depending upon exactly what you're looking for. And we're talking about parts per Brazilian. Could it be that, we've got stuff that's in the ground that's just literally washing off the ground, at some of the salvage yards that is below any of your enforcement levels, but that is causing this consternation amongst the water quality?
You know, I think that gets back to gets back to creating that linkage between. I think that gets back to creating that linkage between what we're seeing in water quality and the sites itself. And I think our, you know, hopefully after our follow-up studies, if that exists, we'll be able to do that. As I think you pointed out, that we're talking about very low levels of PCBs, and so it's not just a matter of looking at the concentrations on sites, but being able to make a good estimate of, okay, how is this being transported in the river itself? Is this a near-field impact? Is this a far-field impact? And then understanding the total loading scope of that. But I would hope through these efforts that if that does exist, that's a gap that we're able to bridge.
So, for instance, would you have, if you put clams in at the mouth of Lower Beaver Dam and find something, would you then go upstream with the clams trying to sort?
Yeah, and that's what we attempted to do. That's, you know, that's exactly what we did in the past. And it's, you know, I think we're able to move the clams up. The question is now when you go to an additional, a single outfall, or even more challenging, a place where there's sheet flow coming in, how do you make that linkage as well? And that's, you know, that's where we need expertise of folks at UMBC to really help us, you know, help us do that.
Great, thank you.
Bill? If three-quarters of the loadings of PCBs and barrels are coming through Lower Beaver Dam, and if you successfully identified the area around Landover Metro as the major source of these, what plans do you have for remediation of those sites?
I'm gonna say I don't think I talk about old Landover, but I don't think we've, again, you know, made definitively a connection between, okay, are the high concentrations that we see in stream here, are those, you know, can you draw the linkage between what you see in that sort of near field concentration and the outlet of the watershed? I would be cautious in drawing that conclusion until we have further studies. But I think the next step is we really have to, you know, if through our studies, if we do believe there is a source there, we really do have to, you know, figure out some way of connecting the individual, you know, the surface runoff coming from the land with the actual water quality. So what are the sites where it's actually coming from? It's one thing to say we have high concentrations here, but it's another thing when we have 20 outfalls in a given area and potential, you know, sheet runoff coming from a spot to actually say, okay, this is the contaminated soil that's responsible for this. So I don't know the answer to it, and I think that's what we're struggling to figure out, what the mechanism is. But I think once we found something, hopefully that would trigger some sort of cleanup.
Did Tonawanda-Costa DC watershed load with 74%?
Yes.
Versus 26% upset. So at that 74%, does that include loading from the bedload sediments?
No, those were, and maybe I wasn't clear on the slide, those were just the terrestrial loads. So the sediment loading is separate from that, and, you know, it's kind of considered, I guess, internal.
Is there an estimate of the loading sediment for TMDL purposes?
I'm actually looking behind you at our TMDL guy right there.
I was about to delve into the TMDL.
I would have to look in the TMDL itself. Some estimate must have happened as a result in it, but I, you know, I don't know. Clearly have that in hand.
The model not presented in the TMDL document, but if you go back to the modeling report, maybe they have that information. But I could look into that.
Yeah, but that 74% does not include loading from sediments.
Correct.
Yeah,
well,
it's not that
correct.
Suspension component. No.
Or yeah. Dissolution.
Okay. All right, let's hear from Prince George's County. And then we'll take questions again and then some questions from the audience before we move to this section. Thanks, Greg.
So good morning, everybody, again. My name is Jeff Dehan, Associate Director with Department of the Environment for the Stormwater Management Division. I'm here on behalf of our acting director, Joe Gill, who is called to another engagement with the county executive's office. But I'm going to be really brief because I'll turn it over to our expert. But as a main focus, our posture inside of the county is obviously one of cooperation and participation with the Anacostia and the toxics issues. We're responding to our MPDES permit MS4 permit. We have a lot of regulatory compliance factors that we administer throughout the county. And also on the development side, our permit review and intake on development side regulates everything that's happening forward. So one thing that we want to really focus on in the sake of today's conversation is try to provide some insight on where we are with support on Lower Beaver Dam Creek. In other words, the county recognizes our responsibility, our role, our involvement with regards to its input to the Anacostia. We're committed for the long term to try to find out what these sources are on the part of the source tracking identification piece with it. We're working really closely with the state in terms of moving into a more aggressive sampling protocol with Lower Beaver Dam Creek. So Chris Clark, who's one of our senior watershed planners, is here to provide a little bit more detail. And it's a very complicated slide, as you'll see coming up, but it's very, very short. I'm just kidding. It's probably as generic as it can be. And we did it purposefully because we're still at a platform where we're learning and we're trying to understand and interpret our level of engagement on how we can best move forward with this program. So, Chris?
Thanks, Jeff. I see some familiar faces in the room. Again, my name's Chris Clark, and I'm with Prince George's County and Stormwater Management Division, Senior Watershed Planner there. I've only been with the department for about a month right now, so but I've been working in and around Chesapeake Bay on different watershed studies and remediation projects for a little over 25 years now. So looking forward to diving into this project head on. I think Greg hit on a lot of points that I'm basically going to speak to. Let's see if we can get this going. So great big box around Lower Beaver Dam Creek. Obviously, we know what the issue here is and what the goal might be, but the actual objectives are a little bit fuzzy. As Greg spoke to, we have this history of high hits, low hits in the water column, and then again trying to track that back to a specific a load from a non-point source, whether it be a stormwater outfall or a sheet flow, is going to be that much more difficult. So as we draw this box around not only Lower Beaver Dam Creek, but as it, around the Anacostia as a whole, internally we're kind of looking at this as a road mapping process. Again, we have this overall goal, this overarching goal that everyone wants a clean, swimmable river, and who wouldn't want to achieve that? But what we need to do, and especially when we get down into that county and other stakeholder level, is to be able to identify and pinpoint those specific objectives, whether it be sub-watershed level or greater, and identify which stakeholder can address which concern, what the barriers to those concerns are, how do we overcome them, what's the timeline associated with those, and then most importantly, how do we start to measure success? That's where we're going to be able to not only direct our funding, but also make sure that funding is directed at the best levels possible to be able to achieve the best net result that we can in the shortest amount of time. So again, to Jeff's allusion for this diagram, and again, we've only got a couple slides here, and it really doesn't take more than this. We have created a pretty good characterization of the watershed so far. We have a very robust GIS team. A lot of our information has already been digitized. We have all of our infrastructure, all of our outfalls, all of our land use, land cover, a lot of the sampling results, historical sampling results as well have gone into that. Going back to Greg's presentation, we are actively in conversations with MDE and UMBC to develop this source identification plan. They're going to partner with us again in Lower Beaver Dam Creek to do the mussel surveys and be able to again see what's there in the water column today, and then see if we can then using that historical data and current data begin to start to track that back to the source. That will ultimately lead to some targeted sampling. Now, with the county, we are able to sample wind right-of-ways, and also within the column, obviously the state regulates toxics, so as soon as we are able, and this is why this iterative approach is so important, and working with the stakeholders hand-in-hand, They'll be able to help us out with particular old investigations, new site investigations that may have to take place. So again, that information will be fed into a data analysis. We'll look at it, we'll see where we are. It may, you know, work backwards into some more targeted sampling, but ultimately it'll result into some action. Now, whether that action is, again, okay, now we know where we are, we know the current state, we know where we think we're going. So let's again plug it back in, and this is obviously a living, breathing organism, this watershed, and we need to make sure that we keep this document as alive as possible as well, and keep updating it. And again, this road mapping process and the watershed characterization, it's going to be an active, ongoing, living thing that can be updated as we go. So eventually we'll start to tighten the noose. This is the hope and the prayer that we'll be able to tighten the noose on this and be able to identify those areas of PCBs and other toxics where they can be remediated. We'll go ahead and try to get that going. So, you know, again, we've got a lot of stakeholders in here. For those of you that I don't know, my contact information is here. Please feel free to reach out to me. I want to talk to you, you know, one-on-one, as groups, anything that I can do to help illuminate our efforts a little bit better, I'm happy to do so. Question?
So give us your best professional estimate on how long that'll take.
Years.
How many years?
Let's see. If you want to take PC degradation in a normal anaerobic condition and place it out, you know, it's going to degrade over decades. Decades.
Is that your question? No, my question is, how long is it going to take before we get to finding where they are and remediating?
We won't know until we get into any kind of source identification plan, until we identify those hot spots and be able to develop an action plan around cleaning those up. That's when the timeline
for... You've been at this 20 years. In your professional judgment, is that 5 years from now? Is it 10 years from now?
No site's the same. It's going to be 5, 10 years. Yeah.
First, council members of the Cleaner Anacostia River Leadership Council. First, council members. Trey?
This is for you and for Greg or Jeff or anybody that wants to jump in. What's your impression of the relationship between the potential sources that are still coming in versus how much is just sitting in Lower Beaver Dam Creek right now?
So what's been measured has been what's in the water column itself, and that's going to vary according to time of year, storm events, things of that nature. That again, as Greg alluded to, PCBs are not readily miscible in water, so they are adsorbed onto soil particles. So the finer the sediment, the more it's going to get up into the water column and move. So you know, it's hard to tell because we do have multiple non-point sources, sheet flows, and again, these stormwater outfalls that come from a variety of different sources. Some of these sediments may get trapped in the catchments themselves along streets and may not be resuspended until a large storm event. So until we conduct this track down study to a level, it's hard to provide any specificity as to what's bed load characteristics versus what's being added from
the idea from being non-point. Is there value to moving forward with a cleanup in stream so that it stops contaminating the Anacostia you go after terrestrial sources?
Greg may be able to answer that a little bit better.
My general thinking would be to look at the terrestrial sources first and not, you know, I guess, let me caveat that. You know, there might be a need to clean up in stream, and I wouldn't know. I think we need to do additional studies, but I think we do need to have a handle on what's coming off the land, just to know that, you know, have a pretty good idea that we've controlled, you know, if there's a significant source, that we've controlled it before cleaning up directly downstream of it.
Just semantics. Are you sure. Term tightening the noose?
Yes.
And just given the climate of the country right now, it may not be the best time to use in the future to describe it.
You're absolutely correct, and my apologies. No, we're trying to close the gaps. Maybe that's a better turn of phrase.
Okay. Any other questions from the council?
Have you guys tried to look at the
this is your major tributary into the Anacostia. Like, to what extent, or have you tried to model, like, what, how far that would have an impact in the Anacostia based on the loading that it has?
Right. To date, maybe someone with TMDL from MDE can talk about that.
So I think that the best estimate to date is coming from that 2017 TMDL where we see that...
you can speak up?
Oh, excuse me. The best estimate we have to date is the 2017 TMDL where we have estimates of the actual, that interface between the non-tidal Lower Beaver Dam Creek and the tidal Anacostia. We're seeing about, you know, I think it was about 20% of the load into the Anacostia from terrestrial sources coming from Lower Beaver Dam Creek. What I would say is there's, you know, through the toxics TMDL and through the sediment project and going on right now, I think we'll be able to have a better estimate of that when the results of that modeling come out. So I think that's, you know, both going to be a more sophisticated model and also a more updated model. So I think, you know, in the next few years, we should have a better estimate of what's coming out of each of these tributaries.
I guess what I would... I probably didn't ask it that great. So I'm looking at it from the potential of, say, cleanups occurred in the Anacostia, and the strength of this source being able to recontaminate those areas downstream in the tidal Anacostia to any significant degree. Because, you know, when this comes from Beaver Dam Creek, it's going to enter into the Anacostia. You may be able to track it for a while, but then you're going to lose it, I think. And so when it goes back to these things of, like, how long is these studies going to take, and it may take years and years. But I would argue that does not prevent you from moving forward on addressing other sites in the river.
No. And when I was talking about years and years, I was talking about overall degradation and the natural state for PCB contamination in general. So what we're trying to do is really, you know, laser focus some of our efforts the best we can on those historically bad actors, those sites that are, whether they're hot spots or whether they're areas of contamination, so we can control that sediment runoff and stop that from actually entering into the water column. That's the general, you know, idea of this is to stop it, whether it be sheet flow or through some other type of outfall, before it that suspended sediment reaches the waterway.
Trey?
So I'm unclear. One of you said that sampling, our assessment of loading is coming from in the water column. The other of you said that it was a terrestrial source sampling.
Well, the sampling that's been done in the water column has been a bivalve study. So those are, you know, snippets in time to be able to calculate the actual concentrations in the water that give us an idea of where along that main stem the contamination may be. Greg,
you right, and I suggest something? I think we bring in a lot of different types of sampling. We do sediment sampling in stream. We'll do water column sampling in stream, both grab samples and passive samples, where we put out this, like, a plastic thing that just absorbs PCBs, and then you look at it after a certain duration of time. We also use clam studies, and then when we go up into the terrestrial areas, we'll go and do grab samples of water coming out of the outfalls during storm events. We'll do potentially sediment samples in stormwater collection areas. So I think there's just a broad suite of PCB sampling tools that we've used in the past and will continue to use in the future.
Is your impression that Lower Beaver Dam Creek is moving most of that PCB material through into the Anacostia River, or do you think it's acting as a reservoir, where it's mostly receiving most of the time, and then occasionally, maybe on a big storm event, it's flushing?
Well, I think with any of these urban streams, what you're going to see is right during dry times, you're going to have a gradual buildup, and then during big storm events, you're going to see a flashy, you know, erosion going into the stream. So, you know, it's a matter of right time period, you know. But I do expect, given the flashiness of these urban streams, that there would be, you know, substantial movement through the stream.
Okay, I keep asking on this subject because I'm interested in why we wouldn't move on at least a, you know, really cursory cleanup in stream now that we've identified it as such a large portion of the loading. Because every year we wait for studies, more people are getting sick. So people are eating fish out of the river, and it's not just a academic issue at this point. We know it's a public health issue.
Correct, but if as we discussed, there's a significant amount of flow through between the stream, and you go and clean up, and then we do find there's a terrestrial source within the watershed that's fairly directly connected up between the tidal river and that source. You're going to end up doing that same cleanup a couple of years down the line. But I do think, there's sediment cleanup going in the Anacostia as well, and I think compared to the, I could be wrong, but that should have a significant impact on the water column itself. I think it's, over the long term, it's the long term buildup of potentially stuff coming off the landscape that we're concerned about. But in terms of actual, in other systems that we've looked at, the potential PCBs coming out of the sediment itself can be very substantial compared to the annual.
Okay, Doug?
I think back on when we set up this council 5 years ago, one of the things we talked about very explicitly at the time was that the council might have the ability to encourage Prince George's County and the state of Maryland to pick up the pace, to accelerate the pace of actually doing this stuff. And I don't know whether that's happened over the past 5 years, but I'm pretty sure that if I put it to a vote here, we'd have a unanimous vote that Prince George's County and state of Maryland should try to pick up the pace of doing the studies and getting the remediation. So I don't want to put it to a vote, but I do want you to go home with the idea that at least some of us here in the council would like you to move this along as quickly as you could.
Yes, sir. That's why I'm standing here today.
All right.
Yes.
I just want to respond to that. Part of this, I happen to Lee Curry with Maryland Department of the Environment. We are definitely committed to moving forward, and you can tell we've been working on this for a while. Greg pointed out that PCBs are not easy to find in the watershed. He handed me some pictures last time. We have inspected several of those sites. So as Greg pointed out, we've done 80 inspections across 20 different industrial sites. We're working on construction permit, the MS4 permit. Yes, that's really important, and we're teaming up and have provided some financial resources for the monitoring piece of it, just as we're looking at wastewater plants. So we're moving full steam ahead. We're committed. We would like to know also from this council and the members, what are we missing? Is there something else that we should be doing that we're not doing? Not just the pace piece, but is there something else? And I think related to the question Greg was answering about the cleanup, should cleanup occur now or later? I think we have information to say that. I have to be cautious in terms of answering that question and what information we would need to answer it. But I do think it's really important to look at the comprehensive work that we're doing, to think about where we could adjust it, where we can nudge it, and where we can find those sources. I do want to bring back that one point of, if there's different information about where the terrestrial sources are coming from, we're currently seeing, and we understand that it's to be 3/4 of PCBs are from D.C., 1/4 from Maryland. We know we need to focus on Lower Beaver Dam Creek, and we have confidence in those numbers also. So I think there's some outstanding questions that we want to work with you on, both from the science side, finding the source, and fixing the source.
Okay, last question from the council.
Yeah, so one thing to maybe consider, I've been thinking about this, and I think I could probably give you some examples, is while you're continuing to look for sources in the Beaver Creek watershed, to try to minimize sediment, especially fine-grained sediments, moving out of Beaver and into the Anacostia. So there could be some mechanisms to help contain it.
It's possible.
In the stream. And not let it grow out.
Okay, from the general public, Marion.
Yeah, a couple of things. One, how are you coordinating with the district? I know the district just put out a RFP to do some sampling and specifically.
So the county participates in all of the COG work groups. And work groups such as this to make sure that we're active and a willing and able stakeholder in any and every group that may want our help or input, because again, we need their input and ideas as well. This is not a one person show. It's not just me standing up here. It's not just Prince George's County standing here. We need to engage everyone involved in these efforts to be able to, you know, bring this to some successful, you know, conclusion at some point.
I mean, in terms of in the trenches work.
In the trenches work, again, I've been here for a month, so I don't know if Jeff could speak to exactly what, you know, we've been working on.
No, we've had, he would actually flip back to that other slide before that precedes Miriam. actually, no, I was talking about the contacts, but we're actively engaged, as you know. I mean, we are participants with the different levels of all the COG meetings. We have interaction with the active participants that are involved with this entire issue. Our staff is in communication, trying to understand what is the best path forward. I think one thing that we need to be aware of, as old as this issue is, and especially dating back to 2005 or even earlier with the Lower Beaver Dam Creek, we are just now getting at a level where we haven't been involved at that level since 2005. We became acutely aware of this, you know, just a couple of years ago. Now we're trying to push together a plan that's going to educate us so that we're in shared information between DC and Montgomery County and Prince George's County, so that we don't jump out of the gates with a knee-jerk reaction that's going to have minimal impact and deliverable versus doing the education piece and understanding it up front first collaboratively. That's going to best put us in the best posture to make decisions. How do we remediate?
Okay.
So, that's it.
One more quick one.
Yes, Mary.
What's the stakeholder engagement plan? It's just contacting these agencies or something.
Well, it's things that's, on. Go ahead.
That's who we're engaged with right now. And, okay. I mean, and beyond this, I mean, we're engaged here as well. But these are the direct contacts and people that we're engaged with on a immediate level today and try to move this issue forward.
As far as informing the general public,
there's multiple levels of communication on the public from this level to the county's level. We have communications with property owners, with our HOA committees, community partnering events, let them know where we stand. We have information on our website, the DOE website, that speaks to the Clean Water Act and our role with that.
All right. Thank you. And thank you to Jeff, Chris, Greg. And I just have to say, in terms of my role, that the relationship between us and Ben Grumbles is extraordinary. Secretary Grumbles has continued to reassure us that this is a priority for him, especially in relationship to our partnership just on the whole on Chesapeake Bay. Adam Ortiz was very close to us, and now he's over in Montgomery County. And so he hasn't gone far, so he's still involved. We look forward to continuing the relationship with Prince George's County. So thank you all very much. So next, we'll hear from Deb and Wesley. Are you part of this? And Deb, take it away.
Yeah, good morning. Deb Morali here from DOE. I'm the RPM for the Anacostia River Settlement Project. So we're going to talk about feasibility studies with focus on beneficial reuse. So for the feasibility studies...
Deb, be clear. Beneficial reuse of what?
Beneficial reuse of material that is going to come out if we're going to dredge the material. So what are you going to do with that? Either they have two choices. Either you can send it to off-site, transport and dispose, or you can use it in the river and then use it for other purposes. So we're basically recycling it so that it's not kind of a environmentally, it's more conscientious and sustainability-wise, I think it's much more beneficial. So that's what the purpose is for. So we got three operable units, Washington Channel, Kingman Lake, and the main stem, okay? So for the feasibility purposes, those are three divided to make it easy to operate and manage. And then on the suboperable units in the main stem, we got like Pepco, Washington Gas, and Navy Yard. So each of those entities are doing their own RIFS, so we're gonna take, in terms of the reports that are gonna come out, and then how we can integrate this into our Anacostia River Sediment Project. Primarily, I think for every feasibility studies, it's a cookie cutter thing, and we still have to go through this 9 NCB criteria, which is standard for any circular sites. So this is overall protection of human health and environment, which is the threshold criteria, and then compliance with ARRs. And then the primary balancing is criteria is long-term effectiveness and permanence, reduction of toxicity, mobility, and volume. And then short-term effectiveness, implementability, cost. and then modifying criteria, state acceptance and community acceptance. So in order for us to be successful in terms of taking the remedy from the initial phase all the way to the end stage where the record of decision is made, we have to make sure that we meet all these 9 criteria, and then we go through that exercise for each of the options. Now, these are some of the general response actions. So you can see it starts from the no action, and then institutional controls, monitored natural recovery, and then enhanced recovery, monitored recovery, and then containment, which is capping, removal, it could be in situ treatment, ex situ treatment, disposal, beneficial use, and then ancillary treatment. So this is like a standard cookie cutter. Now you look at the entire gamma of technologies and see which one of them would be really screened through, and then it will fall into place where you can take it and further move the process forward. So we start with this long list of technologies. Question? Again, for the feasibility studies, I think those of us who have gone to the EPA sediment conference, we have seen this adaptive management, which is the buzzword these days for all sediment sites. What is adaptive management? Basically, we look at sites in its entirety, and then in very smaller scale where there are real problems, and see if you can tap those sites and initially address them, and then monitor with time, then you can see some really benefit in terms of reduction of toxicity, mobility, and volume in those sites. So when you minimize the risk, the overall risk is reduced. So that is the idea behind adaptive management, which means that you understand exactly what you're monitoring and then see if there is an real impact from any of those remediation that you're proposing there. So these are some of the things we feel that for the Anacostia River sediment projects, we recognize that there are quite challenges and uncertainties. So we recognize that the climate change is for real. So how do you account for the climate change in terms of the process moving forward? And then what are some of the key metrics of ongoing data that we're going to be collecting? Because we know that any amount of data is not enough for us to make decisions. So we always keep looking to see how can we have a more information available to us to make some of those uncertainties go away. Okay, so this is part of the some of the studies that we are doing right now, which is the fish monitoring and sediment fish sampling and sediment sampling that we're going to monitor, and then we're going to create a baseline which will be compared against when we do the actual remediation. Then we talk about whatever among those technologies, however you choose it, there has to be an element in terms of how do you dispose that. Because when you talk about contaminated sediments, some sort of a remediation is required, irrespective of what technology you choose. When you talk about any sort of a remediation, specifically you're talking about dredging, then we talk about what are you going to do? You can just basically dredge it and then haul it up. That's the easiest thing to do. So, or we can say, well, we can dredge it, but then is there an opportunity for us within the district to reuse that material, for beneficial reuse? So it could be basically transferred to create a wetland, So, or it could be a park, or it could be used for industrial purposes. So there could be multi-purpose use, and that could kind of benefit, because again, we're looking at sustainability elements in terms of how do you keep this to reuse, okay? So as we are seeing here, I think the living shoreline, this is living shoreline, I think kind of provides some opportunities for us. We look at some of the submergent or emergent wetlands on the riverside. So those are some of the plans that we have for DC. So when we have these plans, what we want to do is to look at those plans to see how we can integrate all those plans and then kind of use all those opportunities to the best of our use there. So how do you do that? So you take a look at an entire package and see how we can mix and match to solve that puzzle there. So, that's a net saving for us, because Number one, we're not going and spending money twice. You know, we're going to spend only once. So the question is, how do you integrate those? And that's where the challenges come into play. Okay, but that's a part of the planning, you know, when you have all the team together to make that really work, you know. So again, the, as I said, the land-based parks are recreational facilities, then the water-based parks, land cap material, and then fill our cover at brownfield sites. So, and this is one of the examples from the low-profile sill from the living shorelines. You know, as you can see, you know, this could be one of the options that could perhaps be utilized for the Anacostia River Sediment Project. So again, the objective there is to minimize erosion and then enhance flood control and prevent, you know, scouring in the river there. So, and then again, this is for the areas that are deeper. So you can use the bulkhead, you know, basically, you know, you use the existing bulkhead and then reinforce it, you know, with additional layer of a bulkhead, and then, you know, sediments and create some marinas and you know, launch pads and stuff like that. So these are all some of the plans that are there already in the living shoreline. So we want to take that and see how we can utilize that for our benefit here. So some of the valuable benefits of really creating a bulkhead fringe or sill wetlands, you know, to reduce the impacts of managing contaminated sediments, and then of course, it limits the sediment from you know, exposure to odors and dust traffic. And then, you know, the key thing here is, again, we are enhancing the local ecosystem and biodiversity, you know. So I think the objective is to be as natural as possible, so to keep that in mind. And then for we are also creating opportunities as a result of increasing the riverfront access. And then, again, as I said, the mitigate flooding, you know, that is something that we have to do, because it's in our own interest to look at, you know, what the 1 year, 10 year, 100 year floodplain, and then look at some of the situations and see if we are trying to get prepared from now on. And then increase the shoreline resilience, and then as you can see, it's going to have a real positive economic and social impacts in the river that can attract, you know, riverfront for the commercial use. And then the last thing is, really, you know, we're trying to integrate the social, environmental, and economic components on the, which are the key three principles of the sustainability, you know, into that. Okay, so social in the sense, you know, everybody can access the river. When we talk about environmental, you are kind of minimizing the risk to human environment. Economic is basically anything that you change, you know, to a more natural conditions will create, you know, economic benefit to the district and the residents. So that's what we're talking about here. The additional benefits, you know. So again, this is a great for using on the in the. For using as a structural fill, you know, if you need to, this is something we're going to work with Public Works to see some of the sediments can be really, you know, utilized. Again, I think there's a perception that when you talk about contaminated sediments, everything is bad. Everything is not bad. It's only toxic if it exceeds RCRA metals and, you know, toxic levels. So if you just take it out, the reason that it's toxic is because it's being exposed to the aquatic species, fish, mussels. Okay, and human. So once you take it out, it's not contaminated. Again, that's the determination that will be made based on the chemical, physical, and biological characteristics.
It doesn't have to be taken to Nevada or something. It doesn't have to be taken to Nevada or something.
No, not at all. Because I think that is the point here. Because I think people have this misconception that because it says contaminated, the word, it kind of gets all go crazy. Okay. So that's just, I just want to make sure that they recognize that. And then if you, we already have some success here in looking at the Kingman Lake wetlands and then emergent wetlands in the main channel of South of Benning Road. And then again, it saves money for us. You know, we keep everything local and not spend money in transportation. You know, look at the carbon footprint we are reducing as a result of not transporting that. And again, it's good for, and again, this is a resource. We have to utilize. We got a very small district here, so we got to make the best use of the resource. Okay, all right. Let's see. This is a, this just came straight from the DOE living shorelines. I think you guys can read this. Again, the goal is to enliven the hardened shoreline, adjust to climate change, I think provide and protect habitat and increase shoreline access for recreation. So this is a, this is available online, and I think you can use that. Now, how do you synergy? How do you use these priorities? You know, of all these projects, and kind of combine that as I discussed. It's a challenge, no question. But again, this is not your cookie cutter feasibility studies. You know, you just take it and all the technologies, and then you integrate and then come out with the alternatives here. We are really looking at this from the future perspective, you know, 10 years, 15, 20 years down the line. How can we take all these plants that are there in the shelf and kind of activate and integrate them to a point where we are not duplicating the effort, we are saving, you know, in terms of what we're trying to do there. So, and then you can see all these plants. There are so many plants there. I don't know if anybody talks to each other. I'm not sure. So we want to do that. Okay, we want to make sure to make it easy for everybody to understand that it's in the best interest of everybody to work, you know, in sequence here. So, okay. So again, there's a plan for all the new marinas, the boathouses, the boat launches, you know. And I think this really provides an opportunity for us to think along the lines, you know, big visionary ideas here. Okay. So the lawn dredge. Material and waste. Wesley Rosenfeld.
Thanks, Dev. I'm Wesley Rosenfeld, Assistant General Counsel here at DOEE, and I work with Dev and the other remedial project managers here on sediment issues. Just kind of wanted to take a step back. Dev was kind of getting into the specifics of how dredge material can be beneficially reused in the Anacostia River. But, you know, everything that we're doing here is pursuant to laws that the district has to follow and other regulations and guidance. And so when we're putting together this feasibility study, one of the things that the law requires is that we consider all of the available remedial technologies that have been used in the past at other sites and that are generally just known in the sediment remediation context. And so one of those technologies that we will be considering in the feasibility study is the beneficial reuse of dredge sediments because...
Hold on a second. For those that are on the phone, either mute or if there's more noise, we just have to shut it off. If you're on the phone, you're going to have to mute. Okay, turn it off. Just push the red button. Okay, go ahead.
You know, we know that one of the technologies that we'll be considering is dredging the river, and associated with that is the beneficial reuse of that dredge material. About a year or so ago, when we started really thinking about the feasibility study here at the agency and what would be in it, we talked internally here at DOE and with our sister agencies regarding sort of what's on the books now and how, what would control sort of the disposition or the placement of dredge materials once they're taken from the Anacostia River. There's not much on it here in the district, but there's no prohibition against the beneficial reuse of dredge material. And just in general, from all the laws that are on the books, dredge material is not considered a waste unless it contains a solid waste or a hazardous waste, as Dev kind of touched on. If something's considered a solid waste, if you place it somewhere that would be considered dumping, that's not something that we're interested in doing. Now, while federal law regulates the management and disposal of hazardous waste, the management of solid waste or non-hazardous waste is typically left to the states for regulation. In this place here, it would be the District of Columbia being the state. The National Contingency Plan, which is the regulations that our agency is following to evaluate various remedial technologies for the feasibility study. Requires that cost be considered when evaluating the effectiveness of remedial technologies, and promotes keeping costs low by allowing the consideration of innovative, lower cost remedial technologies that are as effective as higher cost technologies. So more specifically, as we're talking here, you know, the lower cost remedial technology would be the beneficial reuse of dredged material that's not going to be posing a risk to human health and the environment, versus the disposal of that material somewhere off-site.
I have a question. So
okay, wait a minute. Are you done?
Oh, no, I have one more slide.
Okay, let's get through the slides, and then we'll do it.
Sure. So when I talk about guidance on dredged material and waste, you know, one thing that we're in the process of, and more of the beginning process of drafting a guidance document. It could be in the form of guidance, it could be in the form of regulation, but basically, you know, DOEE feels right now that we need to have something clear and concise for that will show the public how we would be using, beneficially reusing dredged material for the sediment project, for other projects in the river that are currently happening or may happen in the future, just so that there's a sort of clear rule book or playbook of how this material is going to be used or assessed when it's taken out of the river, if it is taken out of the river, and how it could be reused. So we'll be providing, through this guidance document, clarification on when and how dredged material can be reused in accordance with district law and policy. And it'll be relevant for the sediment project, other Anacostia River in-river cleanups, and any future in-river cleanups in the district as a whole.
Thank you, Wesley. So first the questions will go to the Leadership Council, but let me say that as many of you are kind of recognizing, that as we do climate mitigation, I mean, already the Navy Yard has stated that they're going to be putting in a new wall, and in order to reduce the likelihood of the 500-year flood. The Fort McNair is going to have to do the same thing sooner or later. And we are also helping them look at the difference between a living shoreline and just a new bulkhead. But what you see is that these are PRPs, these are responsible parties, and that they have to harden their assets, and that if we're going to provide guidance on how the material can be reused, but we're also ready to provide leadership if someone needs to pull them together and say, you need to look at these being part of your plans. I mean, with the National Park Service, not to get too far ahead of anybody, but we can see at Haynes Point. Haynes Point not only floods regularly today, just as things get worse, it's going to be flooding or underwater sooner or later, in that there needs to be a plan of what happens at Haynes Point. So this can be part of that. We're interested in that being part of that. We won't be a passive partner. We will help provide leadership if we need to coordinate all the parties together, but federal government has their own process. But with that, we will provide local guidance of how the material can be reused. And with that, open the floor to the Leadership Council. Tony?
Do we have a big issue with daylighting, and how would that factor into more permeable surface along the shore?
Is there anybody from
Jeff, you want to answer that?
Jeff, you want to answer that?
Yeah, sure. I'm Jeff Seltzer, Natural Resources here at DOEE. So, we have looked, and we're certainly interested in doing daylighting projects and streams throughout the district. We've done one in the Northwest, and I think the next one that I know that's on the list is maybe has the potential with Stickfoot that follows Super Parkway. The truth is that there aren't that many opportunities that were looked into it, but I think there are that many opportunities to daylight based on the built infrastructure that's been built up over the many decades since the streams were buried or piped. We're very interested in it. It's a good outcome for us if we have more opportunities.
So it's not that there are not that many streams, it's that there's just too much building now over the streams?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
That's the process. Okay, we'll start here. Steve?
Are you looking at sites outside of the district as possible
insights for them? You know, there's other wetlands being built other places that could potentially use them without talking about any specific sites right now.
So, what the guidance? I don't know what if it would actually pick sites or select sites where dredge material can go. It would be more of general rule saying if the sediment is at between this and this level, then it can be used in these types of areas, like residential areas. If it's between here and here, then it can be used in commercial areas or parks. So it wouldn't be saying specifically where dredge material
but
should
but if
be
those,
used.
For example, were in Virginia, you'd have to meet those standards over there too. And so, is that something that you'd be looking at as to what those standards are? You know, is there potential to not have to truck but to barge material down somewhere to use it, and other options like that?
I imagine that would be something that we would consider. But you know, we're, like I said, we're at the very beginning stages of all of this. But that's a good point.
Fred Pickney. I like the idea of beneficial reuse. The cautions always are, in some places, the sediment contamination is much higher as you go deeper. And so I assume that would be part of the feasibility study, analyzing what you're exposing now that's left in the river and whether you need, you know, the risks and balances between taking something out to give you more depth and maybe reduce the risk at the top at the same time not exposing more toxic sediments to the surface.
Yeah, it's a good point, Fred. I think what I want to say for that is we again look at the physical, chemical, and biological characteristics. The first thing is to test the sediments that are there and see in terms of the impacts. If it's very hot, you know, obviously, you know, you don't want to be going and putting in you know, some areas that are ready for beneficial reuse. So that's going to be categorized basically based on the contamination of the soil, okay? If it is meets the human health and ecological criteria, that will pass. Then, only then, that can go, okay? So as Wesley said, residential area, commercial areas, industrial areas, so there is a category of four different types of, I would say, piles to distribute the pattern of the soil, and then depending on that, that can go there. So there may be areas that contamination is very high and that just cannot be simply, you know, reutilized. That, in that case, either it has to be pre-treated, you know, and then add some amendments to kind of make it more amenable for reuse, or it should be basically transported off-site. So that will be determined based on the analysis and testing.
Okay, in the leadership council, Bill.
Yeah, just quickly, I think this is an excellent presentation that Deb and Wes have put together here, and I just happened to sit down at a place that had a copy of it, which has 8 more slides of case studies, etc. So, I would recommend getting this out to everybody. I think it's full of all kinds of good information.
Tammy?
I'm just curious if this guidance document will also contain the standard by which you will be using to evaluate.
Correct, yes. That will have basically types of analysis that are required for each of those categories of soil, and then the limitations, and then how that can be utilized. Yes.
So screening levels or something that can
correct.
To
it,
that
it will be compared against EPA level, region 3 site sediment screening levels, and then we're going to also use the NOAA squirts, you know, methods. I think the Maryland has come out with an excellent guidance document, our friends, you know, August 2017. And I think if there is any place to go to in terms of reference, that's a good start to begin with. Again, we are utilizing that as a good reference to begin with to plan for our guidance document. So everything that I'm going to be showing you, some of the examples of case histories, you know, they're all in Maryland, basically. They have, you know, Baltimore, Harvard, that have been dredged, and most of the stuff pretty much stays within Maryland. I think they got a fantastic story to tell, you know, and they have been doing this for quite some time. So I think we got a lot of neat stuff, you know.
So just one more piece.
Go ahead,
so
Tammy.
I know the district doesn't have a clean fill standard, so will that sort of, will you build off of this to develop a district-wide clean fill standard?
I don't know if we have an answer to that question right now.
Yeah.
My comment was exactly what you already referenced. I just wanted to make you aware of Maryland is really trying to advance beneficial use, reuse material. So I'm glad you're looking at our 2017 document.
Absolutely. Yes. I have a copy right there.
Okay.
Yeah. So I did look ahead to the examples. I'm very familiar with them too. And for the most part, a lot of the big case studies for beneficial reuse come from navigational dredging projects. Okay. And so that doesn't mean that just because it's a navigational project that the containment level could be higher than the remedial thing. So, in dealing with the core, there are different things to consider in that. But, you know, for the Anacostia, I was wondering if, like, on the Potomac or somewhere, there's going to be a big, like, if there's a source to bring in the material from a navigational project close by. I don't see necessarily navigational dredging to any large extent on the Anacostia, right?
I mean, the navigational dredging is really an Army Corps of Engineers responsibility, yeah. Really, you know. I mean, we shouldn't be combining the environmental remediation to the navigational.
If you want to build wetlands and things like that, you're going to need a lot of material. You know what I mean? So you could benefit, and you would probably want the contaminated material deeper and then covered and planned. So, you know, I think also, but I guess what I'm looking at is there's a lot of examples at specific waste sites where material has been managed on site.
Well, I can give you an example.
At a much smaller scale
than
things like, you know,
Masonville. Yeah, the best example I can give you, New Hartford
Harbor,
there are like five CDFs, contaminated disposal facilities, basically, you know, in the river, aquatic carrot cells, confined aquatic disposal. Basically, they have like five different cells. Those concentration of PCB is like almost like 800 parts per million, and they cannot just take it off. That's the most cost-effective way to keep it in place, you know. So they have done it, and obviously, you know, the Great Lakes have the, you know, a lot of examples. I'm going to show you a slide there. So I think there are sites that have been used, you know, for various purposes. At least the confined aquatic disposal, or even for Maryland, I think they have used for CDF, which is on the land, basically. You know, same thing.
I mean, I don't think you're going to have CDF in Anacostia, but
no, I'm not. I don't think we're going to have it. So there is a possibility that CDF or combination of that.
So as we move along, I take one question from the public in the back.
Never mind, we answered it. Thank you.
Okay.
Marianne? One unanswered. What happens to the dredge material that's taken out of the Bladensburg Marina? I know that's Corps of Engineer, but I just wondered if you all know.
Chris Georges would have to tell you that. What happens to dredge material that's regularly?
It's a function of park and planning. They operate that site. They used to take that up to you across the river on Colmar Manor. It's stored in a large excavated area basin.
There are ponds, but they also remove by truck.
They,
I
after the
what they do with it.
It's at discretion, similar to what's been discussed here. It's determining levels of contaminants, and it's reused at different levels, like at ballparks, if it's found that they're not any high levels of toxins or anything in it. But so it's regulated and then distributed out to different areas based on the all the soils.
Okay. Last question for the public. We have to move.
This is sort of a two-part or two questions.
Identify yourself.
I'm Hal Siegel. I'm a lawyer with Beveridge and Diamond, and I represent Washington Gas. I'm not speaking for Washington Gas, but this question is my question for now. And it's just not consulted with anyone. But my first question is whether you've talked about these. Approaches relate to what happens to material once it's dredged, but we touched on an earlier question on which relates really to whether you're developing criteria for when to dredge at all. So, for example, if you have contamination that is at a much lower level, you have 5 feet or 10 feet of sediment, and then you have a contaminated layer, there can be issues about whether dredging should be permitted or whether dredging is the right approach. Are you developing criteria for that? And then the other part of my question, which I will admit is really somewhat separate, is trying to understand the broader context of why we're talking about these approaches to management of dredge material now. You mentioned adaptive management, the PRPs. Does this relate to what you're thinking about with the feasibility study? But they're really two different questions.
Well, I, you know, on a broader level, I think it would be irresponsible if we didn't look at ahead of time, if there's dredged material, where can it go? We do have some hot spots, like up the channel, that can be dealt with. And certainly looking at what's already capped by nature, if we don't have to go any deeper, that, you know, that's part of, it's already adapted. But Deb, do you want to add?
In terms of the deeper material that is contaminated, obviously the first metric that you need to decide is whether or not they are bioavailable. Okay? If they're not bioavailable, then we shouldn't be bothering with that. That is the key metric, because obviously, you know, sediment is not the problem itself. You know, what is available through the pore water, through those benthics and organisms that whenever we consume, drink, and then aquatic and fish in turn, you know, basically, you know, so take those. So it's all, again, risk, it comes back to the risk assessment in terms of whether or not that's risky or
enough. Happy to have a fuller discussion about what bioavailability is, right, with our science team. Last question, Trey.
Following on that same note, when you're assessing bioavailability to determine risk, how far out climate-wise are you looking at more severe storms and more severe flow?
Well, for that, I think we look at the hydrodynamic modeling. We're using 1 year, 10 year, 100 year. Okay, we're going to look at the for all the different events, you know, see pros and cons in terms of what happened, cause and effect in terms of all those, you know, and then account all those factors into that. So.
Okay.
I just wanted to also kind of temper expectations, because we've talked a lot about, you know, beneficial reuse. It's just something that we're going to be considering in the feasibility study. It doesn't mean, I don't want you to go back to your, you know, constituents and say they're going to be beneficially reusing dredged sediment in the Anacostia River, because I just, you know, we're coming up with guidance to help us analyze and assess if that's a proper and efficient and legally responsible thing to do in the Anacostia River.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, everybody. Next, Aaron. Aaron will give us updates on the Urban Waters Federal Partnership.
All right, just the, mm-hmm. Am I? So, I have 3 minutes.
You can do it, Aaron.
Yeah, right. And way too many slides already, so I'm just going to sort of unloosen the fire hose and let this go, and then if we have time for questions, we can go through it. My name is Aaron Garnes-Holmes. I've been the ambassador with the Urban Waters Federal Partnership here in the Anacostia Watershed for the past couple of years. And the way that the Urban Waters Partnership works in our watershed is that it kind of dances between the many efforts happening, like the Sediment Project Cleanup and the Watershed Restoration Partnership, and sort of picks little projects. And so Gretchen asked me to give an update on originally the Anacostia River Pool Project, which is something that we've sort of been involved in, but then kind of give a little bigger context. So that's why this sort of vague title about project updates. I'm really just going to update you on two projects that are happening that relate to the sediment project and to restoration in general. So just to sort of let you know what my work is, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out, kind of like what Deb referenced to, what the heck is going on and what are all the different plans and projects for different parcels along the river. And so I'm not going to click on this, but I could go to this interactive sort of Google map I've created where you can actually zoom in and click on different sites and see which agency has purview over this, what's the plan that's underway, can you click to the link to go to that website and learn more. And I've kind of built timetables about what's coming down the line, what's the 4-year pipeline across, color-coded here, the orange is the remediation projects, like the sediment project, brown is transportation projects, open space projects, private development, all these things that are all interconnected, because they all relate to each other in the end, and a lot of times they actually directly interface, the sort of result of one planning process and another should be interlinked, but aren't always necessarily. So we're here in quarter one of 2019. You can see we've got a lot of decisions coming up for these cleanup projects, but at the same time, there's a lot of transportation projects coming down the line in the same like 2-year time period, and a lot of new neighborhood development. So I'll sort of echo Deb's call that we need a little bit more coordination between a lot of these efforts. One of the projects that I want to give you a quick update on is the Anacostia River Pool effort, which directly relates to this sediment project because it's sort of like, what do we get from all this restoration that we're working on? In the end, I think one of the biggest things is to hopefully someday be able to actually jump in the Anacostia River. So we had a feasibility study done. It's been presented to this council before, so I'm not going to like tell you all the details. You can go to anacostiariverpool.com now. There's a website home for it. But I'll tell you a little bit about what's happened since the release of this study. We presented on this down at the 10th biannual conference on the remediation and management of sediments, which you'll hear about next on the agenda. So that's Gretchen talking to somebody about some of the sort of the big questions that this feasibility study answered, like, is the water going to be safe for swimming? Is the sediment a problem? Where would it go? What would it look like? And one of the big questions that people ask is, why are you doing this anyway? And the answer is because people say they would use it. We did the Anacostia River use survey, which is still out and online. People are taking this. And there's a question about swimming, and nearly everybody who answers the question about swimming says, yes, I would jump in the Anacostia River if there were sort of a safe, controlled, official way to do that. So people want to do it. There's also a history of swimming on the Anacostia River. It's not a great history. As you maybe know, the pools in D.C. were segregated until 1949, and so some of you know Dennis Chestnut. He tells stories about how he couldn't go swimming in the pools, so he would actually swim in the Anacostia River. And then even when they were desegregated, this is a photo from the Anacostia pool riot down in the Fairlawn neighborhood. There's a public pool there. There were riots when they desegregated it over the issue. So even when it was opened up, a lot of black children didn't feel like they could go to that space, so they still swam in the river, including up by the Kenilworth landfill, which then was an open-air burning landfill. So like that felt safer than going to the public pools. So building a new sort of safe space to touch the water in the Anacostia can kind of start to not necessarily address the past, but address the gap that now exists across African Americans in the country, where 70% of folks don't know how to swim, which is five times worse than other ethnic groups. And part of that is just because there's been a lot of things like this sort of pool story that have separated black communities from water. So we're sort of addressing that as well. So we have to look at the sort of big question, is the water actually safe? And DOE has been taking water quality samples for a long time and comparing them against the Class A, you know, swimming standards that or EPA standards that the district has adopted. And pretty much we're doing great on temperature and pH. Turbidity is a little bit worse, and then E. coli is the big issue for swimming. And on the sort of, this is over between, I don't know where the laser is here, between 2011 and 2015, about 40% of the time we were failing on E. coli, but that means that 60% of the time we weren't. So there are days when the river's actually safe for swimming. And the policy's been changed now, where just like in the Potomac, you can apply for a permit if you do appropriate tests up to the day that you want to do an event, and you pass all the tests, you can host a swimming event in the Anacostia River. So we're all very excited and looking to the DC Water Clean Rivers project to sort of address a bunch of the E. coli issues. They're projecting a 98% capture rate of all of the combined sewer that's flowing into the river, which is the primary source for a lot of the E. coli. Of course, this past year was the wettest year on record, so the numbers weren't as exciting as they could have been. So DOEE's been tracking at a few different locations E. coli throughout the year last year, and the bottom bar here, this pink line, is the standard. So we didn't really do well last year. There were maybe a few times when we were just barely getting below that standard. But the Anacostia Riverkeeper has also been taking studies up and down the river, and this is sort of organized from upriver here to downriver in the channel. And while there's a lot of pink on this graph, pink means that they did a test and it failed, versus greener tests that passed, there's still some green on here. So there are still days when you could swim even during the wettest year on record with a lot of stuff flushing into the river.
You mean Trey did all this?
Yeah, by himself. Yeah, I'm sure.
And friends.
He can tell you more, along with DOE, about how the agency and Riverkeeper are now sort of amping up monitoring efforts and launching a citizen science program and going to do more testing sites and frequency to get a better picture this coming year about how much better is this actually going to get. But Of course, other places that have problems like this have done this. So this is in Copenhagen. They swim in their harbor now. They built a sort of a floating dock, and people jump in the water in the middle. And then they also have some sort of shallow areas where it's only a couple feet deep, but it's still the harbor water that people are in. And there are globally other places, mostly in Europe, where these things have been constructed, but there are other U.S. cities that are planning to do this in Boston and New York. So I was talking to the folks in Boston, and they were like, I don't know, it's moving slow here. You guys might actually beat us, which would be great if we could be the first sort of big U.S. city to put a new, to reclaim our river for swimming. And the what could it look like is one of the questions. Just want to clarify that this idea is that people are swimming in the actual river water, not like a filtered pool or a floating bathtub. And it could be as simple as jumping off of a dock or creating like that sort of shallow wading thing like in Copenhagen or building a big structure. And of course it relates to the land use nearby, much of which is sort of pending changes, so it needs to be incorporated into future planning, but you could build a beachfront area where people can be out with their towels and umbrellas. And talking about living shorelines, I just have this sort of dream that you could actually build some sort of way to get into the water in a sort of a wetland environment in a controlled way to think of. The cool thing right now is infinity wetland pools in rich people's backyards. Like, what if we had a public version of that along the Anacostia River? So Smith Group is an architecture and landscape architecture planning firm that did this study for us, and their staff did some sort of crazy brainstorm renderings of what these could look like. These aren't plans that anybody's pursuing, but it gives you an idea of, yes, you can have a cool floating structure that creates different kinds of experiences for touching the water in a safe and controlled way. And then here's some pictures that I just put in to say, like, what if we kind of mixed shoreline restoration with public access to the water. Maybe it's not a pool, but even just ways to get down and touch the water in that more sort of naturalized environment. As a trained in landscape architecture,
yes,
that's what I really hope for. And then, of course, the study looked at where this could go. There's a lot of different options up and down the river, and it depends on how deep is the river, how do you access the edge, how narrow is the river, and I think in each place something's possible. The structure would look different. It might be narrower or shallower or more simple, yeah, depending on where it is. But this sort of gets back to the point that we need to be incorporating a lot of the different planning initiatives that are going on, because wherever a pool may be adjacent to, it would need to be incorporated into the land use planning that's happening in that place. So another project I'll just give a quick update on to connect to that is the Kenilworth Park, the northern part of Kenilworth Park, which is one of the sites that was looked at for where a swimming facility could go. So the National Park Service and DOEE are working hard to come up with a plan to remediate the former landfill, and once that's complete, the northern half of that will be transferred to the district. And there are many community groups who are wondering, then what happens? What's this going to be? And they, here's a picture of the landfill, and here it is in the timeline of cleanup. So hopefully around the same, you know, in the next year or so, we'll have a proposed plan for that site to be remediated. But there are community groups that are already sort of polling neighborhoods and pooling together resources to start to talk about what that park could be in the future. The Clean Water Action was out actually knocking on doors and talking to neighbors, and groups like Washington Parks and People and other folks in the Anacostia Park and Community Collaborative are already starting to have these conversations. So I sort of encourage government agencies to kind of join in that process and hold hands so that this doesn't become antagonistic later. So I'm going to skip the last part of my presentation, which is sort of my soapbox, where I talk about how we really need to develop a new vision for the Anacostia River. We don't need necessarily more plans. I have a spreadsheet of like 85 planning documents for different sites along the Anacostia River. What we really need is like a vision that ties all that together and sort of sets the bar for like what are we hoping to get out of all of these initiatives, and for the ones that directly interlink, like a pedestrian bridge being planned to land in a park that's being planned separately, can we like do that together? And so DOE has been great about looking into ways to start to launch that effort, and other agencies and COG are also excited about it. So this is just sort of, hopefully we'll kind of be all coalescing around this as the leaders of a cleaner Anacostia River to start to connect a lot of the many, many, many efforts underway. So that's my 3 minutes.
Thanks, Aaron. That's very exciting. We're going to go straight on to the takeaways from the 10th Annual Conference on Remediation Management.
So we, I think we have the show of hands. But there were a lot of us in the conference. So this happened in New Orleans in February. So this conference has been going on. It's every other year. So this is the 10th conference, the 20th year. I thought I would, what I did is I reached out to all the stakeholders that attended. So we had representatives from DOEE and our consultants, plus Washington Gas, AECOM, we're with them, and plus the consultants from the Park Service. So there was a bunch of us there. And this is the second time I've gone. The first time, it kind of is the people all over the country, a lot of Canadians and also Europeans that are really working on these sediment cleanup projects in the developed world, we'll say. And the first time I went, I felt like it was a little bit all home week because everyone knew each other. Now I'm a little more in the club, there's still, hold on. Oh, I got it. So there's different technical tracks. One of the things that I liked about this year versus 2017 is now, because these river cleanups are getting more along, they're taking more time to talk about restoration. Before, it was more, you know, this is what we're dredging, we're looking at a lot of the academic institutes, we're looking at, you know, how to treat contaminants. That's still all there. This goes on for 3.5 days. You start at 8 o'clock in the morning, you go to 7 o'clock at night. So there's 5 different rooms going on simultaneously, so you really do get somewhat overloaded with the information. But you can, you know, pick between what you're interested in. And there's panel discussions. We had Dr. Ghosh was leader of one of the panels, and Betsy Ruffle was also from AECOM was a panel lead. So that was, you know, good to see our stakeholders and participants there. In this case, this was the ones that were directly related to the Anacostia River Sediment Project, and I'll have Dr. Lombard will come up and talk about the UMBC work briefly. Then we had a bunch of posters. Aaron showed our poster on the swimming, but then we also had Tetra Tech doing some of the work that we've done on illicit discharges, and they will come up and quickly explain what they did there. So I'm going to turn it to Dr. Lombard to give her famous oversight.
Slide. We've got a little bit of time.
Yep. Sorry, yes, I tried to prepare a summary slide of what we presented at the Sediment Conference. So Dr. Ghosh is not available today, so that's why I'm replacing him. And so we presented at this conference a poster in the platform focused on the Anacostia River and the watershed, on the transportment and transport of the pollutant and the uptake into freshwater organism. And so our presentation were focused on the freely dissolved concentrations that are present in the water, because the concentration, the pollutants are bioavailable to organism, and that will be bioaccumulated to the higher trophic level of the food chain up to the fish, which is the main driver of human health risk. So on the left side, I presented some of the summary results for the different phases that we were monitoring. With in the middle panel, you have the water presented in blue and pore water concentration. The PCB we presented for other pollutants, but here I present only for PCB. And so for the x-axis, you have the PCB concentration that was detected freely dissolved. And on the x-axis are the different sites. Here presented only the main tributaries and background site on the far left. Of the Anacostia watershed. And in red, dashed line is the EPA water quality criteria for protective for human health through fish consumption at a cancerous level of 10⁻⁵. And what you can see on the water concentration is that you have one of the sites that is standing out for the high PCB concentration that were way above EPA water quality criteria, which is Lower Beaver Dam Creek. And when you look at the pore water concentration, which is in brown, which is a concentration that is detected in the freely dissolved concentration in the sediment, we have a same tendency that is seen at the different tributaries, with again lower beaver dam showing with the highest concentration in the freely dissolved concentration in sediment. Another phases that we were measuring were the mussels that were co-deployed at these different tributaries, and the concentration that we detected in the tissue was reflective of the concentration that we detected in the water. So on the middle panel, you have a summary of characterization of input and output into the Anacostia River. The Anacostia River, so our main findings based on the freely dissolved concentration is that the Anacostia River is a source of PCB to the atmosphere. So the water concentration is very, very high, that although we can detect PCB in the atmosphere of over the Washington DC area, the concentration in water is so high that we have actually a volatilization into the atmosphere. Regarding the different location of the Anacostia River, the sediments, some of the sediments have very high concentration of PCBs. They are acting as a source. And the majority of the sediment are actually a lower concentration and are acting as a sink. And regarding for the tributaries that we were monitoring, on the freely dissolved aspect, lower beaver dam actually standed out with very high concentration and very high loaded into the Anacostia River. So yes, that's the main point that we want to highlight is showing and highlighted lower beaver dam creek as a main concern for contamination into the Anacostia River.
Yeah, thank you. We're just using this as multiple line of evidence to really understand what's there in the upstream tributaries. So I think this study kind of illustrates the fact that you look at the water and air and pore water and muscle, they all kind of match in terms of what is it telling the story wise, you know. So.
And Dr. Ghosh presented this presentation here at the council in, I believe, September.
Yes.
But we can always do another update as we get more data.
Okay, is there anyone else on that, this particular part of the agenda?
Yes.
Okay, let's move.
Okay. I think it's
thank you.
And then Catherine.
We'll make it quick. I think we've actually presented on this as well for you guys. So this is, I presented on three different methods for calculating preliminary remediation goals for our primary risk driver for the Anacostia River, which is fish consumption. So we're looking at the connection between sediment and fish tissue. So fortunately for us, we have a lot of data that we've collected over the past few years. We have benthic invertebrate tissue data and all levels of trophic level tissue concentrations for fish. So we have the forage fish and all the way up to the top trophic level. So basically, leveraging all those data sets, we looked at three different methods for calculating preliminary remediation goals. These are back calculations based on the risk-based concentrations for fish tissue. EPA guidelines set these standards. So the first one is really a very basic one. It takes the top predator fish fillet tissue concentrations that were used for the human health risk assessment and are also the basis of the fish consumption advisory. And we look at the sediment concentrations over the entire river and do a back calculation that tells us at what level the fish tissue concentrations will clean up if we set the sediment remediation goal to that. So that's the very simplest calculation there. The second one, we actually modeled the forage level fish up to that predatory level. So we took our forage level fish tissue concentrations and looked at bioaccumulation and biomagnification up to the top trophic level and did a back calculation to assess what the sediment concentrations would be that would be safe for consumption. I'm simplifying this a lot, and I can tell you a lot more details about these if you would like. The last one that we looked at the invertebrate prey tissue. So we're looking at clams and snails in the tissue and how those biomagnify and bioaccumulate up to the top predator fish. So those were the three methods that we evaluated. And we compared them and looked at the background threshold values. So we did all of these calculations looking at both the current and recreational, current and future recreational anglers, as well as the subsistence anglers. So those are the three colored bars on each of these charts here. The top chart here shows the three methods compared to each other. Method two demonstrates that all three exposure scenarios result in a preliminary remedial goal above the background threshold value, which means that it's an achievable method for cleaning up the sediment to that concentration. And the second chart there just shows some spatial variability. Those PRGs on top are for the whole river, and the one down below is actually broken up for the river reach by reach. So it's showing actually a more realistic way for how we would be eventually maybe applying a remedial goal. So you can see there is some variability from reach to reach for how those remedial goals would be applied.
Why wouldn't birds be included? That would further concentrate in birds, wouldn't it?
Right, so we're looking at what the risk for human consumption is, which is all in the fish. We actually found in the ecological risk assessment that there is no unacceptable risk for birds.
That was strictly modeled, though, correct? That was not
sampled.
That
was modeled. We did not take tissue from the birds. No. And that was
okay.
It.
Great. Next.
It's for human consumption.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. You got 1 minute.
Yeah. I'll be brief. My name is Antoine Muller. I'm with Tetra Tech. I'm in environmental science. We've worked very closely with DOE on a lot of projects, one of which was the Hickey Run investigation. We used a multitude of different techniques in source tracking during that investigation, one of which was of particular interest, was the use of canines in tracking illicit connections to the stormwater system. So you can see here in this map an example of our movement up pipe in the storm system, and the canines were able to bracket an illicit connection, which allowed us to concentrate our traditional tracking and sampling techniques, and it helped really decrease the amount of time and costs during the investigation. So I went.
That's perfect. That's fun stuff, too. Okay.
Oh, wait.
No,
we have Catherine from Washington Gas.
One more. Okay. All right, Catherine, welcome. Thank you. The canine thing we may want to hear more about at some point.
And then there's actually Betsy from AECOM has to say a few comments.
So I went to the Sediments Conference for Washington Gas on behalf of them. I guess there's... there we go. So I attended in 2017. I also attended in 2019. There's definitely an increase even in just those 2 years to try to expand our toolbox as we're dealing with sediments. So listed a couple of options up here. Probably the three biggest takeaways that we had as a team was that the Great Lakes Legacy Act program was hailed multiple times as a great example of federal cost sharing and local sponsors coming together to collaborate and work towards a common good. Since time is short, I can get more into that. If you have questions afterwards, I'd love to talk to you. Another driving topic was understand, don't assume, which I think we all agree with when it comes to our connections between the sediment and the fish. One particular platform that I did sit in, which was really interesting, they had tagged their fish, both local as well as fish that had been farm raised, and the tagging allowed them to trace with radios kind of where these fish were staying, and everybody thought they were local fish, except they had multiple fish that actually exited the area that they thought they were confined to, and they actually had one little guy who was very, very aggressive and ended up 125 miles away. So we referenced that on one of the slides that will be available, that's online through Battelle. You can look up that presentation. And probably the last one, I think Gretchen mentioned it as well, and it's been mentioned in a couple of presentations today, this idea of sustainability and forecasting and how adaptive management can be an integral part of that long-term solution.
Okay, Gretchen, I'm going to put a pause here.
Okay.
And a lot of people have to leave probably right at 1. 5 minutes left before 1, but at 1, for those that want to remain and hear what the calendar is for the next steps in community engagement, Gretchen will be going over that.
Okay.
But, you know, I hate to be on a committee or a task force and group where it's all presentation and then it's over. I mean, part of why you're here is to be able to provide input, ask questions, make statements. And I want to first invite Jim, who's on this, if you would, is there something that...
So, thank you. Jim Foster, Anacostia Watershed Society. I'm going to simply ask that we look at having 2 meetings after this meeting here today, where all of the parties can get together and discuss several topics broken down into the process of how we're doing this, technical issues and questions, communications, and how we can better move forward together. Okay, so that is my ask today. I think everybody I've spoken to in the room and on the phone and others all agree that we all want to end up in a certain place. We haven't clearly defined that place yet, but we all have varying opinions on how we get there. So it would be very helpful, I think, if we could get together and speak to that and spend a little bit of time on that process. Thank you.
So some feedback from my role is that we've got the Leadership Council. We also have requirements around public engagement. And public engagement usually is around asking for comments to a report, then we provide comments back, and it kind of creates a legal relationship of being able to say we did it, but also to try to make it meaningful. What would be helpful, Jim, is instead of having free, I'm not saying you're proposing free-for-all meetings, but would be helpful is to use the vehicles that we have, which one of them is this Leadership Council. And if your request is for a couple more frequent meetings of the Leadership Council to provide guidance to the government on how we proceed forward, you know, I'll defer to my co-chair on this, but I'm very open to that rather than coming up with a new group or new forums.
I appreciate that. And I don't disagree with that, but that can be a topic for discussion. We have a minute or two here. This could probably be an hour-long conversation or longer, just even to set the game rules and the guidelines.
I'm talking about more meetings, and I don't know what else you're referring to. I don't know if you're referring to the consultative working group.
Well, and I broke it into 3 big topic areas: the process of how we're getting to an end game of clean. I can break that down if you'd like right now, but I'm trying to keep it very brief here. I am requesting.
I'm only viewing at the forums right now.
Right.
What you're asking to be created.
Right. I'm simply asking for 1 and probably 2 meetings that we can come together and discuss these topics. And there's subtopics underneath them: the process, why we're considering 2 records of decision, how we're moving forward, was there an opportunity for more collaboration and better communication. It seems like, and I'm again just the spokesperson for a lot of the people associated with this, but we are not speaking with one voice. We're hearing of many different approaches to things.
So Tony can speak for himself, but what I'll say from the mayor's side is that the mayor has this council. And the expectation is the council provides guidance to us on this issue. There's also the joint group that we have with COG. It goes over a lot of the same stuff. There's potentially also the meetings that we've held where it's just open in the community where we've done presentations. My preference is to stay with the mayor's council for doing what you're talking about. unless it doesn't cover it. But I'm going to defer to my co-chair in this as well.
One, if I could just have a second, a commercial. I want to commend the staff. Does a beautiful job with the preparation for the meetings. Been to a lot of meetings. The preparation for the meetings, the work that all of you are doing is really fabulous, and it's great to see. You know, we only dreamed of it years ago that Marilyn, I know, I mean, Doug's point is a good point. When are we going to get there like the kids in the car? That said, though, we're in the car at least, which we were before, and I appreciate Marilyn and PG, sorry, Prince George's County's involvement in all this, which raises a point. I think, in addition to the point that Jim is making, I think that, for example, just one example, Aaron had a great presentation about the need for a vision over the not only the river but the whole watershed. A lot of us have been talking about this for years now. That's, I mean, we could just dig in on that and spend a lot of time. You know, the sediment cleanup is something worthy of a lot of time. All that said, I'm not sure why we can't do what you're saying, Jim, in the context of the leadership group.
Well,
just spend more time and get.
We can certainly discuss that further here now. I don't, you know, want to be thrown under the bus or throw anybody else under the bus, but, you know, I'll be blunt. I've asked, and I'm not getting I'm not getting it, okay? So I would like to have this conversation, and we can decide if it's a separate meeting, but I think that the people in the room here who really care are listening closely and want to have a say in that. So we can decide how that happens, and we just want to happen. We all want to come to a place where, you know, we can go home at the end of the day and feel like we did the best job we could. So I don't think there's anybody in the room that doesn't feel that way. So we agree on some of those very basics.
Senator, you had your hand up first.
Yeah, I mean, I would just support what Jim was saying. And with this mayor, with the advisory council meeting, I would suggest that the format needs to change from presentation and being able to ask a question, maybe, to having a discussion on this stuff. So it has to be organized differently. And it's not a free-for-all, but there's a lot of topics to discuss. Risk assessment, PRGs, feasibility study, and give our input and not just be in a review.
But you'd be comfortable with this being the gathering.
Yeah.
And obviously,
if there's enough time,
because it's an official body, it would not be a private. I mean, it would be an open meeting.
Some of these meetings might be a day, you know, versus an hour or two. You know, that type of thing. But yeah, I think that this group could work. There's enough expertise in the room.
The analogy I think of is of a crossword puzzle. In the case of the river, it's really a 3D crossword puzzle because you've got depth and you've got sediment and that sort of thing. But what's going on in a lot of people's minds is that we're all here to hear what pieces of the puzzle are going in, when, and how it's all being fitted together. But I think there's a sense that a lot of people have a lot of things riding on this piece, that piece, or that piece, and they want to know when and how it ought to be put together, and they want to object if their pieces aren't being put in the right places or at the right time. It's that kind of thing.
That's a great analogy.
Doug?
Very good. That's
I'm fine with using this as a forum. I don't think we have to be locked into quarterly meetings. There's nothing
wrong with absolutely. It does not have to be quarterly.
I feel very frustrated because I gave up 4 hours today, if you count travel time, to come to this meeting, and I don't have any idea whether we're on track toward our rod or not. I'm going to leave here without having any idea where we are in our core project. Let alone having the opportunity to input on it. I just won't even know. Nobody told me.
I think what Gretchen's going to go over at the end is where we are in the calendar and what's happening next on community engagement as well. But you should have that. It's just, it is a media agenda. We got into a lot. I wanted to be sure this conversation happened, so that you weren't even more frustrated that you didn't have a chance to share your frustration. Yes?
I think maybe what I'm hearing is that people are willing to have a couple of longer, closer together meetings to flesh out some of this meaty stuff. And I appreciate DOE's consideration of people's time and trying to fit in as much as possible on a regular schedule and makes it easier for us all to get here. But I think if we could pick maybe 2 days to kind of focus in on maybe what we were discussing kind of offline was the FS and how it's moving forward, that would be really helpful. And I'm getting a sense from the room that people could commit to coming for a much longer meeting if it were focused that way.
Trent?
We've also been asking in various formats to see the FS materials that are in place or drafted or sort of drafted or sort of pulled together in whatever embargoed form, and we haven't seen that. That didn't even make it on the agenda today somehow.
Well, we haven't received the draft FS yet, and there's some integrity of the relationship of the science of when they do the first draft that we've gotten your comments, we've heard a lot of folks to see if it's even in the ballpark. And then also, can never under, I know sometimes it's frustrating, think about how frustrating it is for my team, never understate the relationship to a National Park Service who owns the river bottom and us that has the water. And so we're co in this, and we're not, you know, we may not be on the same legal track completely in terms of timeline, that the rods may diverge depending on decisions, because we, you know, you guys testified, we're on a legislated mandated rod time. The Park Service is not. But that doesn't mean that that legal relationship between us and the Park Service is ever gone. And so we're going to respect that, because they've been close partners with us. And so what is done with the initial draft of saying, did it get in the ballpark or not, or is there something weird in there that people need to understand better, is part of that partnership with the Park Service, because of the legal relationships that we have. Then how we get FS going forward is something we talked about together.
And I think that the group believes that there are some alternatives that could help meet a schedule, for instance, could help understand better what the thinking is. Right now, there's a lot of concern about where the FS ends up, and perhaps it's very generic. It's a generic one instead, but we have, you know, in both directions, the NGOs and the PRPs, very concerned about, you know, the specific issues that are going to relate to that. So, for instance, we've talked about adaptive management. We're hearing it all around, but that is there needs to be a framework if that's what we're going to do. We could, for instance, have a temporary record of decision that would meet our legislative requirements that would allow us to work together to do some things. Perhaps it's early, you know, early on work, and we just need to have that framework and those guidelines together. I know that some folks are very interested in getting into the river and doing some work now that could be done, you know, regardless. But we need to resolve some of those things. And
none of that's been brought to us, but that is, we're very open to full participation.
Right.
On the note of a very quick catch-up, have you received the background data from NPS?
We have the data, but we're waiting for the report. And Pam, you think the report will be done in April?
Donna's better to speak on
that. Yeah, we're assessing the data right now, and the report will be available in April.
To public and this room, or?
Yeah, that's when we plan to have it released, yes.
Okay, and then has the U.S. Fish and Wildlife data come back, the first round?
Yeah.
You're shaking his head, no. No.
Was it? It was submitted, but hasn't come back yet.
Correct. It's in the lab right now.
What's the ETA on that?
Not 100% sure.
Did you put a year on it?
Yeah.
Well, it depends on how many shutdowns they're going to have.
Well, I'm hoping within the next 2 months.
So you know, there's also some major concerns about communication, and it goes both ways. You know, we can't have responsible parties go into interior and other places and, you know, complain about stuff that we haven't even resolved yet. And at the same time, you know, we need to know what the dates are going to be, because, you know, we're looking at a trajectory to try to get meet a legislative requirement. But I think it's you know, a sit down, roll up our sleeves kind of thing.
I will get dates out for
a meeting that will be, I think the initial meeting will be no longer than 2 hours, to talk about where we are in process. And hash through some of the relationship stuff that may be opaque to you guys, that is completely clear to us, but maybe opaque to you. And so we need to be transparent on that. And I know that, and I encourage this, that some of the PRPs are meeting with you guys. That's great. The degree to which the NGOs and the PRPs get on the same page makes it easier for the government. So I encourage that, but maybe some of that thinking can be brought to that 2 hours, especially if there are proposals for doing early cleanup activities, that kind of stuff. So we'll try, and we'll need to know what's needed to be able to respond to a question like that. So we will make a commitment to start getting times out to everybody right away.
So thank you for saying that, and that's exactly what we're saying. I think, you know, I can say that we all are prepared to sit down, you know, after speaking and have that discussion. So you know, we're ready to go.
All right.
Okay.
With that, I'm going to ask Gretchen, our Anacostia coordinator, to give us updates of what happens next.
And your 1 o'clock meeting is waiting for you, so.
Fine.
So if anyone has to leave, I'm not going to go over what Doug would love us to go over, the details of when this document and that document is coming out. As the director noted, we're waiting for the FS now from our consultants, and so this public engagement schedule was kind of based on when we think the documents will be coming out. So we're going to have two public meetings in 2019, and what we're going to do, unless we decide otherwise from input from this group, we'll have the format the same as the RI meeting that we did in last October. So that was, you know, a lot of information, but then we had tables around the side that had a lot of the other groups that Aaron pointed out in his presentation that are involved in the process. And I think that was a good format because, one, we left a fair amount of time for questions. Two, there was, you know, we did have to get factual information out. And also, we were able to engage a lot of different parties. And so I think we're going to follow that format. FYI, Jim, so get your tables ready. So we're going to do similar ones for both the FS, which will be sometime early summer, and then the proposed plan, which basically is now taking all these options that we looked at in the FS, and that will be our recommended option. So that's, you know, kind of the big show. Both of them are big shows because, you know, when we did the RI meeting, it was very technical information. You know, a lot of people came, but this is where, you know, with the FS, where you start really looking at options of what we're going to do to at least think about cleaning up this river. And, you know, people will be concerned, you know, is this going to affect my neighborhood? And, you know, if there's trucks running up and down. So I think there'll be a lot of interest in that. The other item that I wanted to point out was with DC Appleseed, under their existing grant, we decided that we wanted to do some additional outreach into the communities. And we know that the people, the good thing is that the Anacostia River Corridor is, you know, not that big an area, but we do have some interesting populations. The people that we feel that we can't reach as well are some of the seniors, some of the young people, so, and the Hispanic population. So we're going to be working to get a cadre of community ambassadors that will be going out into these neighborhoods using their existing groups that they already are involved in to take the message to them that these plans are happening and they should know about the pending activities on the river. So that's, we're working through the work plan on that now, and we're hoping to launch that as soon as possible. Then we have the summer coming. We have our Green Zone Environmental Program where we have the youth 14 to 24. They will also be, we'll have an Anacostia module again, and that's a good way to get some of the young, the teenagers and the young adults involved in the project. So we'll be working on that. We have our River Explorers Program where the Riverkeeper and AWS are going out in boats. And one of the things I was talking to Jim about, and I don't know if I got to mention it to Trey, but, you know, they have their standard script of what they talk about, you know, fun things on the river, doing creep, but we're going to also have them, what we want to say about these, the project. And so we'll work with some of the people who actually be out in the river besides, you know, you guys, because you also have your your staff to make sure we have a cohesive message of the people who come onto the river in the boats will be hearing about the project. And so we'll be getting that together in the next month or so. We have, you know, these meetings. Brent has agreed to expand our social media presence and work with me on that. So we'll be, you know, more Facebook, tweeting, Instagram, etc. So that will, you know, bring in a lot of the younger people to get them, you know, more engaged with what's going on and at least be knowledgeable that, you know, there's all these great people working on this project. There's always lots of events and we always have, you know, our project at the tables and there's a lot of things coming up now that winter's over. So we have the Anacostia River Festival is coming up, Earth Day, of course, Kingman Island, a lot of work's going on there, and the Bluegrass Festival, Festival del Rio, so we'll be at all these events. And then the other thing is, you know, we're also always open to presentations at specific communities. Like last year we did kind of a significant one at the Sierra Club, and also ANCs, we can do them as well. But I'm kind of, because we're very busy, we'll say, with all these activities, I almost wait for, you know, I do offer that, but I almost wait for them to ask us because, you know, quite frankly, we're not, you know, we feel like we're out there, but we are available to speak to specific communities as well. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're looking at from now to the end of the year, and then we'll make a new, you know, things are subject to change, but this is what we're thinking right now.
Questions for Gretchen?
Hey, Gretchen. Yeah. Good morning, Mike Rooney, Washington Guest. I don't see anything on there for consultative working group meetings. Are those forecasted?
Well, I'll have Wesley take that since that's from the legal team's side.
Right now, there's no scheduled consultative work group meeting. As we continue to work on the feasibility study, we'll consult with the program here at DOEE and Department of Interior and National Park Service regarding working with the consultative work group to discuss technical issues within that document.
Because one of the things, you finish?
Yes.
Thank you, Gretch. One of the things that we're hearing, Tommy had to leave, so ask me to wrap up. One of the things we're hearing is that we want to have more interaction, more consultation, more discussion. Whether it's formally through the leadership group or otherwise, we need to do that. Sounds like we need to look at how we're presenting and interacting with you in a matter of course, whether it's more sessions, longer sessions, need to do that, and particularly around the sediment project. So we're going to be working with it. We've already talked to some of you, we're going to be working with you on that. And the last thing I'm hearing from our friend Doug is, you know, what kind of dashboard can we put up substantively? Where do we want to be in how many months or years, and how are we on the path toward that? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, Mayor, I'm trying to keep myself under control here, but the bottom line is that the City Council said that this ROD had to be done by the end of last year. And then we all sort of agreed, well, okay, we didn't quite make that, but we're gonna give it another 18 months. And so then it gave it another 18 months. And I don't know where we are in 18 months. Maybe there's other people in the group here. They're having private meetings and know stuff that I don't know, but I don't know any of that. And I feel like as a member of this council, that's the core obligation, is to keep the council informed on where we are in the process.
Right. So recognizing it's a three-dimensional puzzle, I mean, I think people are owed kind of an understanding of that. So we need to work on all those different things, and we thank all of you for your contribution. Are there any other questions anyone may have? If not, thank you all so much for being a part of all of this.
Trey, Jim, question. We schedule the seminar next week.
Yeah.
I think we're all gonna. I gotta get some things out before.
That is fine.
I'll see you some dates. Next week.
Good.
Thanks.
When did she tell you that this is a new part of the
grant? Thank you for coming. Always
I'm going to ask you to do it.
All right, thanks for coming.
Hey, I've got to run to another meeting, but maybe we might talk after. Especially, I thought Jim was going to say we want a meeting specifically on the RAOPRG report of last year and discuss all of those feasibility study issues. It's not right to say they don't have a lot of stuff available. We know they do.
I agree. I want us to push for an April meeting and put that as the meeting.
Yeah.
You what? Yeah. Or, Danielle, have you met Ben?
Hi.
Ben, yeah, we met.
Yeah, we were at an April meeting.
That was selling a lot.
Yeah. Welcome to the fray. This is just toxic land. This isn't all the other land. This is just
taking the bits
Thanks for coming along.